the gentle tugging at the edge of his mailbag. Harry threw himself flat. The bag was higher than he was as he crawled for cover, and it jerked once, coinciding with another gunshot. A .22, he thought. Not much rifle. Certainly not much for the valley. He pulled himself behind a tree, his breath raspy and very loud in his own ears. He wriggled the bag off his shoulder and set it down. He squatted and selected four envelopes tied with a rubber band. Crouched. Then, all in an instant, he sprinted for the Roman mailbox, slid the packet into it, and was running for cover again when the first shot came. He lay panting beside his mailbag, trying to think. Harry wasn't a policeman, he wasn't armed, and there wasn't anything he could do to help the Romans. No way. And he couldn't use the road. No cover. The gully on the other side. It would be full of water, but it was the best he could do. Sprint across the road, then crawl on hands and knees. But he'd have to leave the mailbag. Why not? Who am I kidding? Hammerfall has come, and there's no need for mail carriers. None. What does that make me? He didn't care much for the question. It makes me, he said aloud, a turkey who got good grades in high school by working his arse off, flunked out of college, got fired from every job he ever had. It makes me a mailman, goddammit. He lifted the heavy bag and crouched again. Things were quiet up there. Maybe they'd been shooting to keep him away. But what for? He took in a deep breath. Do it now, he told himself, before you're too scared to do it at all. He dashed into the road, across, and dived toward the gully. There was another shot, but he didn't think the bullet had come anywhere close. Harry scuttled down the gully, half crawling, half swimming, mailbag shoved around onto his back to keep it out of the water. There were no more shots. Thank God. The Many Names Ranch was only half a mile down the road. Maybe they had guns or a telephone that worked. Did any telephones work? The Shire wasn't precisely an official information source, but they'd been so sure. Never find a cop when you need one, Harry muttered. He'd have to be careful showing himself at Many Names. The owners might be a bit nervous, and if they weren't, they damned well should be. It was dusk when Harry reached Muchos Nombres Ranch. The rain had increased and was falling slantwise, and lightning played across the nearly black sky. Muchos Nombres was 30 acres of hilly pasture land, dotted with the usual great white boulders. Of the four families who jointly owned it, two would sometimes invite Harry in for coffee. The result was diffidence on Harry's part. He never knew whose turn it was. The families each owned 1 week in four, and they treated the ranch as a vacation spot. Sometimes they traded off. Sometimes they brought guests. The oversupply of owners had been unable to agree on a name, and had finally settled for Muchos Nombres. The Spanish fooled nobody. Today Harry was fresh out of diffidence. He yelled his mail call, and waited, expecting no answer. Presently he opened the gate and went on in. He reached the front door like something dragged from an old grave. He knocked. The door opened. "Mail," said Harry. "Hello, Mr. Freehafer. Sorry to be so late, but there are some emergencies going." Freehafer had an automatic pistol. He looked Harry over with some care. Behind him the living room danced with candlelight, and it looked crowded with wary people. Doris Lily said, "Why, it's Harry. It's all right, Bill. It's Harry the mailman." Freehafer lowered the gun.
"All right. Pleased to meet you, Harry. Come on in. What emergencies?"
Harry stepped inside, out of the rain. Now he saw the third man, stepping around a door jamb, laying a shotgun aside. "Mail," said Harry, and he set down two magazines, the usual haul for Many Names.
"Somebody shot at me from Carrie Roman's place. It wasn't anyone I know. I think the Romans are in trouble. Is your phone working?"
"No," said Freehafer. "We can't go out there tonight."
"Okay, and my mail truck went off a hill, and I don't know what the roads are like. Can you let me have a couch or a stretch of rug and something to eat?"
The hesitation was marked.
"It's the rug, I'm afraid," Freehafer said. Soup and a sandwich, do you? We're a little short.
I'd eat your old shoes, said Harry.
It was canned tomato soup and a grilled cheese sandwich, and it tasted like heaven. Between bites, he got the story. How the Freehoffers had started to leave on Tuesday and seen the sky going crazy and turned back. How the Lilies had arrived, it being their turn now, with the Roddenberrys as guests and their own two children. The end of the world had come and gone. The Roddenberrys were on the couches, and nobody had yet tried to reach the supermarket in town.
"What is this with the end of the world?"
Harry asked. They told him. They showed him in the magazines he'd brought. The magazines were damp, but still readable. Harry read interviews with Sagan and Asimov and Sharps. He stared at artists' conceptions of major meteor impacts.
"They all think it'll miss," he said.
"It didn't," said Norman Lilly. He was a football player turned insurance executive, a broad-shouldered wall of a man who should have kept up his exercises.
"Now what? We brought some seeds and farm stuff just in case, but we didn't bring any books. Do you know anything about farming, Harry?"
"No. People, I've had a rough day."
"Right. No sense wasting candles," said Norman.
All of the beds, blankets, and couches were in use. Harry spent the night on a thick rug, swathed in three of Norman Lilly's enormous bathrobes, his head on a chair pillow. He was comfortable enough, but he kept twitching himself awake. Lucifer's hammer. End of the world. Crawling through mud while bullets punched into his mailbag and the letters inside, he kept waking with the memory of a nightmare, and always the nightmare was real. Harry woke and counted days. First night he slept in the truck, second with the Millers. Last night was the third. 3 days since he'd reported in. It was definitely the end of the world. The wolf should have come looking for him with blood in his eye. He hadn't. The power lines were still down. The phones weren't working. No county road crews. Ergo, Hammerfall. The end of the world. It had really happened.
"Rise and shine!"
Doris Lily's cheer was artificial. She tried to keep it up anyway.
"Rise and shine! Come and get it, or we throw it out!"
Breakfast wasn't much. They shared with Harry, which was pretty damn generous of them. The Lily children, 8 and 10, stared at the adults. One of them complained that the TV wasn't working. No one paid any attention.
"Now what?" Freehoffer asked.
"We get food," Doris Lilly said. "We have to find something to eat."
"Where do you suggest we look?"
Bill Freehoffer asked. He wasn't being sarcastic. Doris shrugged.
"In town? Maybe things aren't as bad as... Maybe they're not so bad." "I want to watch TV,"
Phil Lilly said.
"Not working,"
Doris said absently.
"I vote we go to town and see how things are. We can give Harry a ride." "TV now!"
Phil screamed.
"Shut up," his father said.
"Now!"
Smack! Norman Lilly's huge hand swept against the boy's face.
"Norm!"
his wife cried. The child screamed, more in surprise than pain.
"You never hit the children before!"
"Phil," Lilly said. His voice was calm and determined. "It's all different now. You'd better understand that. When we tell you to be quiet, you'll be quiet. You and your sister both. You've got a lot of learning to do, and quick. Now go in the other room."
The children hesitated for a moment. Norman raised his hand. They looked at him, startled, then ran.
"Little drastic," Bill Freehoffer said.
"Yeah," Norm said absently. "Bill, don't you think we better look in on our neighbors?"
"Let the police..."
Bill Freehoffer stopped himself.
"Well, there might still be police."
"Yeah, who'll they take orders from now?"
Lilly asked. He looked at Harry. Harry shrugged. There was a local mayor. The sheriff was out in the San Joaquin, and with this rain, that could be underwater.
"Maybe the senator?"
Harry said.
"Hey, yeah, Jellison lives over the hill there," Freehoffer said. "Maybe we should..."
"Jesus, I don't know, Norm. What can we do?"
Lilly shrugged.
We can look anyway. Harry, you know those people?
Yes.
We have two cars. Bill, you take everybody else into town. Harry and I'll have a look. Right?
Harry looked dubious.
I've already left their mail.
Jesus, Bill Freehofer said. Norman Lilly held up an immense hand.
He's right, you know. But look at it this way, Harry. You're a mailman.
Yes.
Which can be damned valuable. Only there won't be any mail. Not letters and magazines, anyway. But there's still a need for message carriers. Somebody to keep communications going, right?
Something like that,
Harry agreed.
Good. You'll be needed, more than ever. But here's your first post-comet message, to the Romans from us. We're willing to help if we can. They're our neighbors, but we don't know them, and they don't know us. If they've had trouble, they'll be watching for strangers. Somebody's got to introduce us. That's a worthwhile message, isn't it?
Harry thought it over. It made sense.
You'll give me a ride after...
Sure. Let's go.
Norm Lilly went out. He came back with a deer rifle and the automatic pistol.
Ever use one of these, Harry?
No, and I don't want one. Wrong image.
Lilly nodded and laid the pistol on the table. Bill Freehofer started to say something, but Lily's look cut it off.
Okay, Harry, let's go,
Norm said. He didn't comment when Harry carried his mailbag to the car. They got in. They'd gone halfway when Harry patted his bag and, half laughing himself, said,
You're not laughing at me.
How can I laugh at a man who's got a purpose in life?
They pulled up at the gate. The letters were gone from the mailbox. The padlock was still in place.
Now what?
Harry asked.
Good question.
The shotgun caught Norm Lilly full in the chest. Lilly kicked once and died. Harry stood in shock, then dashed across the road for the ditch. He sprawled into it, head first into the muddy water, careless of the mailbag, of getting wet, of anything. He began to run toward many names again. There were sounds ahead of him, right around that bend, and there was someone coming behind, too. They weren't going to let him get away this time. In desperation, he crawled up the bank, away from the road, and began scrambling up the steep hillside. The mailbag dragged at him. His boots dug into mud, slipping and sliding. He clawed at the ground and pulled himself upward.
Spang!
The shot sounded very loud, much louder than the .22 yesterday. Maybe the shotgun. Harry kept on. He reached the top of the first rise and began to run. He couldn't tell if they were still behind him. He didn't care. He wasn't going back down there. He kept remembering the look of surprise on Norman Lilly's face. The big man folding up, dying before he hit the ground. Who were these people who shot without warning? The hill became steeper again, but the ground was harder, more rock than mud. The mailbag seemed heavy. Water in it? Probably. So why carry it? Because it's the mail, you stupid SOB, Harry told himself. The chicken ranch was owned by an elderly couple, retired L.A. business people. It was fully automated. The chickens stood in small pens not much bigger than an individual chicken. Eggs rolled out of the cage onto a conveyor belt. Food came around on another belt. Water was continuously supplied. It was not a ranch, but a factory. And it might have been heaven. For chickens, all problems were solved, all struggling ended. Chickens weren't very bright, and they got all they could eat, were protected from coyotes, had clean cages, another automated system. But it had to be a damned dull existence. The chicken ranch was over the next hill. Before Harry got there, he saw chickens. Through the rain and the wet weeds they wandered, bewildered, pecking at the ground and the limbs of bushes and Harry's boots. Squawking plaintively at Harry, demanding instructions. Harry stopped walking. Something must be terribly wrong. The Sinanians would never have let the chickens run loose. Here, too? Those bastards, had they come here, too? Harry stood on the hillside and dithered, and the chickens huddled around him. He had to know what had happened. It was part of the job. Reporter, mailman, town crier, message carrier... If he wasn't that, he wasn't anything. He stood among the chickens, nerving himself, and eventually he went down. All the chicken feed had been spilled out onto the floor of the barn. There was little left. Every cage was open. This was no accident. Harry waded through squawking chickens the full length of the building. Nothing there. He went out and down the path to the house. The farmhouse door stood open. He called. No one answered. Finally, he went inside. It was dimly lit. The shades and curtains were drawn, and there was no artificial light. His way led him to the living room. The Sinanians were there. They sat in big, overstuffed chairs. Their eyes were open. They did not move. Amos Sinanian had a bullet hole in his temple. His eyes bulged. There was a small pistol in his hand. Mrs. Sinanian had not a mark on her. Heart attack. Whatever it was, it had been peaceful. Her features were not contorted, and her clothing was carefully arranged. She stared at a blank TV screen. She looked to have been dead 2 days, possibly more. The blood on Amos's head was not quite dry. This morning at the latest. There wasn't any note, no sign of explanation. There hadn't been anyone Amos had cared to explain it to. He'd released the chickens and shot himself. It took Harry a long time to make up his mind. Finally, he took the pistol from Amos's hand. It wasn't as hard to do as he'd thought it would be. He put the pistol in his pocket and searched until he found a box of bullets for it. He pocketed those, too. "The mail goes through, damn it," he said. Then he found a cold roast in the refrigerator. It wouldn't keep anyway, so Harry ate it. The oven was working. Harry had no idea how much propane there might be in the tank, but it didn't matter. The Sinanians weren't going to be using it. He took the mail out of his bag and put it carefully into the oven to dry. Circulars and shopping newspapers were a problem. Their information wasn't any use, but might people want them for paper? Harry compromised, throwing out the ones that were thin and flimsy and soaked, keeping the others. He found a supply of baggies in the kitchen and carefully enclosed each packet of mail in one. "Last baggies on earth," a small voice told him. "Right," he said, and went on stuffing. "Have to keep the baggies. You can have your mail, but the baggies belong to the service." After that was done, he thought about his next move. This house might be useful. It was a good house, stone and concrete, not wood. The barn was concrete, too. The land wasn't much good, at least Amos had said it wasn't, but somebody might make use of the buildings. "Even me," Harry said to himself. He had to have some place to stay between rounds. Which meant something had to be done about the bodies. Harry wasn't up to digging 2 graves. He sure as hell wasn't going to drag them out for the coyotes and buzzards. There wasn't enough dry wood to cremate a mouse. Finally, he went out again. He found an old pickup truck. The keys were in the ignition, and it started instantly. It sounded smooth, in good tune. There was a drum of gasoline in the shed, and Harry thoughtfully filled the tank of the truck, filled 2 gas cans, then stacked junk against the drum to hide it. He went back into the house and got old bedclothes to wrap the bodies, then drove the truck around to the front of the house. The chickens swarmed around his feet, demanding attention, while he wrestled the corpses onto the truck bed. Finished, Harry stooped and quickly wrung 6 chickens' necks before the rest of the chickens got the idea. He tossed the birds into the truck with the Sinanians. He went around carefully locking doors and windows, put Amos's keys in his pockets, and drove away. He still had his route to finish, but there were things he must do first, not the least of which was burying the Sinanians. The Stronghold. 1. It is certain that free societies would have no easy time in a future dark age. The rapid return to universal penury will be accomplished by violence and cruelties of a kind now forgotten. The force of law will be scant or nil, either because of the collapse or disappearance of the machinery of state, or because of difficulties of communication and transport. It will be possible only to delegate authority to local powers who will maintain it by force alone. Roberto Vaca, The Coming Dark Age. Senator Arthur Jellison was in a foul mood on Hammerfall morning. The only people he could get at JPL were PR flacks, who didn't know anything that wasn't being reported on radio and TV. There was no way to reach Charlie Sharps. It made sense, but Senator Jellison wasn't used to having people too busy to talk to him. Finally, he settled for a phone patch into the Space Communications Network so he could hear what the astronauts were saying. That didn't help much because of the static. The live TV shots were bad, too. Was the damn thing going to hit or not? If it did hit, there were a lot of moves Jellison should have made but hadn't, because he couldn't afford to look like a fool to his constituents, not even here in the Valley, where he routinely got 80% of the vote. He'd brought his family and a couple of assistants and as much gear as he could buy without attracting a lot of attention, and that was about all he could do. Now they were all gathered in the house, most of them sitting with him in the big living room. The phone speaker squawked, Johnny Baker's voice, and Maureen came unnaturally alert. Jellison had known about that for a long time, but he didn't think Maureen knew he was aware. Now Baker had his divorce and his Hammerlab mission. Maybe when he got down, that would be a good thing. Maureen needed somebody. So did Charlotte, but she thought she had him. Jellison didn't care for Jack Turner. His son-in-law was too handsome, too quick to talk about his tennis medals, and not quick at all to pay back the sizable loans he asked for when his investments didn't turn out so well, as they almost never did. But Charlotte seemed happy enough with him, and the kids were being well brought up, and Maureen was getting old enough that maybe Charlotte's would be the only grandchildren he'd ever have. Jellison rather hoped not. "Crummy pictures," Jack Turner said.
"Grandpa will get us good ones,"
Jennifer Turner, 9, told her father. She'd found that her grandfather could get photographs and pins and things that made a big hit in her school classes, and she'd read all about comets.
"Hammerlab, this is Houston. We do not copy," the telephone speaker said.
"Grandpa?"
"Hush, Jenny,"
Maureen said. The tension in her voice quieted the room. The TV picture became a crazy pattern of blurs, then sharpened to show a myriad of rocks enveloped in vapor and fog rushing toward them out of the screen.
"Jesus, it's coming close! That's Johnny. Like it's going to hit!"
The TV image vanished. The phone line continued to chatter.
"Fireball overhead! Houston! Houston! There is a large strike in the Gulf of Mexico!"
"Good Lord!"
"Shut up, Jack," Jellison said quietly.
"Request you send a helicopter for our families. The hammer has fallen."
"You shouldn't talk to Jack that way."
Jellison ignored Charlotte.
"Al," he shouted.
"Yes, sir,"
Hardy answered from the next room. He came in quickly.
"Round up all the ranch hands, quick. Any that have trucks should bring them, and rifles. Get moving."
"Right."
Hardy vanished. The others seemed stunned. Jennifer asked plaintively,
"What happened, Grandpa?"
"Don't know," Jellison said. "Don't know how bad it was. Damned phone's dead. Maureen, see if you can get anything. Anybody at JPL on that phone. Move."
"Right."
Then he looked at Jack Turner. Turner wasn't known in the Valley. No one would take orders from him. And what use was he?
"Jack, get one of the scouts started. You'll drive me into town. I want to see the chief of police and the mayor."
Turner almost said something, but the look on Jellison's face stopped that.
"Can't get through to L.A. at all, Dad," Maureen said. "The phone's working, but..."
She was interrupted by the earthquake. It wasn't very strong, this far from California's major faults, but it was enough to shake the house. The children looked afraid, and Charlotte gathered them to her and took them to a bedroom.
"I can get the local phone numbers,"
Maureen finished.
"Good. Get the local police and tell them I'm coming to town to talk to their chief and the mayor. It's important, and tell them I'm already on the way. Let's go, Jack. Maureen, when Al gets the ranch hands together, you and Al talk to them. What we'll need is every friend they've got, all their trucks, rifles, everything. There's a lot to do. Send about half the troops into town to find me, and have the rest secure for rainstorms, mudslides..."
He thought for a moment.
And snow, if Charlie Sharps knows what he's talking about. Snow within a week.
Snow? That's stupid, Jack Turner protested.
Right, Maureen said. Anything else, Dad?
The city hall doubled as library, jail, and police station. The local chief commanded 2 full-time patrolmen and several unpaid volunteer auxiliaries. The mayor owned the local feed store. Government in Silver Valley was not a large or important activity. The rain started before Jellison arrived at City Hall. Sheet lightning played over the High Sierra to the east. Rain fell like the outpouring of a warm bathtub, filling the streets and running over the low bridges over the creeks. Mayor Gil Seitz looked worried. He seemed very glad to see Senator Jellison. There were 12 others in the large library room. Chief of Police Randy Hartman, a retired cop from one of the large eastern cities. 3 city councilmen, a couple of local store owners. Jellison recognized the bull-necked man sitting toward the rear of the group and waved. He didn't see his neighbor George Christopher very often. Jellison introduced his son-in-law and shook hands around. The room fell silent.
"What's happened, Senator?" the mayor asked. That thing really did hit us, didn't it?"
"Yes."
"I saw magazine articles about it,"
Mayor Seitz mused.
"Glaciers, East Coast wiped out."
There was a crash of thunder, and Gil Seitz waved toward the windows.
"Didn't believe it before. Now I guess I have to. How long does that rain go on?"
"Weeks," Jellison said. That sobered them all. They were all farmers, or lived in a community where farming and farming weather was the most important topic of conversation. They all knew what weeks of pounding rain would do.
"Animals will starve," Seitz said.
There was a momentary smile as he thought of the prices his feed store inventory would bring, then a frown as he thought it through.
"Just how much damage did that do? Will there be trucks left? Trains? Feed deliveries?"
Jellison didn't say anything for a moment.
"The science people tell me it'll be raining like this all across the country," he said slowly.
"Jesus Christ," the mayor said. "Nobody gets in a crop this year. Nobody. What's in the elevators and granaries is it."
"And I don't reckon anybody's going to send much to us,"
George Christopher observed. Everyone nodded agreement.
"If it's that bad, is it?"
"Don't know," Jellison said. "Good chance it's worse." Seitz turned to study the big contour map of Tulare and adjacent counties that hung on the library wall.
"Jesus, Senator, what do we do? The San Joaquin's going to fill up, rain like this. Fill right up. And there's a lot of people out there. A lot."
"And they'll all head this way, looking for high ground," George Christopher added. "Where'll we put 'em? How can we feed 'em all? We can't."
Jellison sat on the edge of a library table.
"Gil, George, I've always suspected you both had more sense than you let on. That's the problem, no doubt about it. 500,000, maybe more people in the San Joaquin, and they'll all be looking for high ground. More people up in the Sierra. Went up to get away from the comet, and they'll be coming down here now. People from as far as L.A. will come here. What do we do with them all?"
"Let's get this straight," one of the councilmen said. "It's a disaster, but you're saying..."
He broke down, unable to finish for a moment.
"You're saying that the army, the president, Sacramento, everybody's knocked out? We're on our own forever?"
"We may be," Jellison said. "Maybe not, too."
"It makes a difference," George Christopher said. "We can take care of all those people for a week. Maybe 2. Not longer. Longer than that, somebody's got to starve. Who'll it be? All of us, because we tried to keep 100 times too many alive for a couple of weeks."
"That's the problem, all right," Mayor Seitz agreed.
"I'm not feeding any of them," George Christopher said. His voice was like granite. "I have my own to take care of."
You can't just abandon all your responsibilities," Jack Turner said.
"Don't think I have any to outsiders," Christopher said. "Not if they're going to die anyway."
Some of them won't make it,
Chief Hartman said. He pointed to the big map.
Porterville and Visalia are both in old river bottoms, flood basins. Rain like this, I doubt those flood control dams will hold very long.
They all looked at the maps. It was true. Lake Success hung over Porterville, billions of gallons of water poised to plunge down on the city. Visalia to the north was no better off.
Not just the rain, Mayor Seitz said thoughtfully. Warm rain, while there's still some snow in the high country. Expect that's all melted by now, sure by this afternoon.
We have to warn those people, Jack Turner said.
Do we? Asked a councilman. Sure we do, Chief Hartman said. And then what do we feed them when they all come here? The stock out of Granny Mason's store.
There was a babble of talk in the room.
How long will those dams last? Jellison asked.
All day.
No one knew for sure. The telephone wasn't working, so they couldn't call the county engineers.
What did you have in mind, Senator?
Chief Hartman asked.
Is there time to get trucks down in that area? Strip the supermarkets, feed stores, hardware stores, whatever, before the dams go.
There was a long silence. Then one of the councilmen got up.
I reckon that dam will hold the day out. If the water don't come too fast, it can't stop my truck anyway. I got a big ten-wheeler. I'll go.
Not alone, Jellison warned, and not unarmed.
I'll send my constables down with him, Hartman said.
What happens to the stuff?
George Christopher demanded.
We share, Jellison said. Share? If you share with me, it means you expect me to share with you, Christopher said. Not sure I like that.
Damn it, George, we're in this together, Mayor Seitz said.
Are we? Who's we?
Christopher demanded.
Us. Your neighbors. Your friends, one of the councilmen said.
That I'll go along with, Christopher told them. My neighbors, my friends. But I won't put myself out for a lot of flatlanders, not if they're finished anyway.
The big man seemed to have trouble expressing himself.
Look, I got as much Christian charity as anybody here, but I won't starve my own people to help them.
He started to leave.
Where are you going, George? Chief Hartman demanded.
Senator's got a good idea. I'm getting my brother and heading for the flats with my truck. Lots of stuff down there we're going to need. No sense in letting the dam break on it.
He went out before anyone could say more to him.
You're going to have trouble with him, Mayor Seitz said.
I am,
Jellison said.
Sure, who else? I'm a feed store owner, Senator. I can call myself mayor, but I'm not ready for this. I expect you're in charge here, right?
There was a chorus of agreement from the others. It surprised no one. George Christopher and his brother Ray drove down the highway toward Porterville. Lake Success lay on their right. High banks rose to the top of the ridgeline on their left. Rain fell steadily. Already the lake had risen nearly to the bridge where the highway crossed. Chunks of mud washed down from the ridge above and covered the road. The big farm truck went through the mud patches without slowing.
Not much traffic, Ray said.
Not yet.
George drove grimly, his mouth a set line, his bull neck arched toward the steering wheel.
It won't be long. All those people, they'll come up the road looking for high ground.
Most'll stop in Porterville, Ray said. It's a couple 100 feet higher than the San Joaquin.
Was, George said. With those quakes, you can't tell. Land shifts, raises up and down. Anyway, when the dam goes, Porterville goes. They won't stay there.
Ray didn't say anything. He never argued with George. George was the only one in the family who'd gone to college. GI Bill. He hadn't finished, but he'd learned something while he was there.
Ray, what do they eat?
George asked suddenly.
I don't know.
You ready to see your kids starve? George demanded.
It won't come to that.
Won't it? People all over the place. Salt rain running out in the San Joaquin. Lower San Joaquin fills up. Porterville washes out when the dam goes. People headed for higher ground. And that's us. We'll have them everywhere, camped on the roads, stuffed into the schoolhouse, in barns, everywhere. All hungry. Plenty of food at first, enough for everybody for a while. Ray, you can't look at a hungry kid and not feed him.
Ray didn't say anything.
Think about it. While there's food, we'll feed people. Would you turn people away while you've still got livestock? Ready to stew your dogs to feed a bunch of Porterville hippies?
There aren't any hippies in Porterville.
You know what I mean.
Ray thought it through. They would come through Porterville. To the north and south were cities of 10 million each, and if only 1 in 10,000 of them lived long enough to reach Porterville and turn east. Now Ray's mouth formed a grim line like his brother's. Muscles stood out at his neck like thick cords. They were both big. The whole family ran big. When they were younger, George and Ray sometimes went to the tough bars looking for fights. The only time they'd ever been beaten, they'd gone home and come back with their two younger brothers. After that, it was almost impossible to find a fight. And they thought alike, though Ray thought more slowly. Now he saw it. Thousands of strangers spread across the land like a locust plague, in all sizes and shapes and ages. College professors, social workers, television actors and game show moderators, and writers, brain surgeons, architects of condominiums, fashion designers, and the teeming hordes of the forever unemployed. All landless people without jobs or skills or tools or homes, like locusts, and locusts could be fought. But what about the children? Strangers could be turned away, but children...
So, what do we do?
Ray asked finally.
If they don't get here, they can't cause problems, George said.
He eyed the hills above the road.
If about 100 tons of rock and mud came down on the road just up ahead, nobody'd get into the valley. Not easy, anyway.
Maybe we should pray for a hard rain,
Ray said. He looked out at the driving rain pouring from the sky. George gripped the wheel tightly. He believed in prayer, and he didn't like hearing his brother's mocking tone. Not that Ray meant anything. Ray went to church, too, sometimes, about as often as George did. But you couldn't pray for something like that. All those people, and they'd all die. And dying, they'd take George's people with them. He pictured his little sister, thin, belly protruding, last stages of starvation, the way those kids had looked in Nam. A whole village of kids trapped in the combat zone, nobody to look out for them, no place to go until the ranger patrol came looking for Kong and found the kids. Suddenly he knew he couldn't see that again. He couldn't think about it.
"How long you reckon that dam will last?"
Ray asked.
Why are you stopping?"
"I brought a couple of sticks of 40%," George said. "Right up there."
He pointed to a steep slope above the road.
2 sticks there, and nobody'll use this road for a while."
Ray thought about it. There was another road up from the San Joaquin, but it didn't show on gas station maps. A lot of people wouldn't know about it. With the main highway out, maybe they'd go somewhere else. The truck came to a complete stop, and George opened the door.
"Coming?"
"Yeah, I guess,"
Ray said. He usually went along with George. He had, since their father had died. The other two brothers and their cousins and nephews usually did, too. George had made a big success out of his ranch. He'd brought in a lot of new ideas and equipment from that agricultural college. George usually knew what he was doing. "Only I don't like this," Ray thought. "Don't like it at all. Don't guess George does much either, but what can we do? Wait until we have to look him in the eye and turn them away." They climbed the steep bank behind the truck. Rain poured onto them, finding its way inside their slickers, under the brims of their hats, and down their necks. It was warm rain. It drove hard, and Ray thought about the hay crop. That timothy was ruined already. What the hell would they feed the stock come winter?
"About here, I think," George said.
He scrabbled at the base of a medium-sized rock.
"Bring this down. It ought to drop a lot of the mud above it onto the road."
"What about Chief Hartman? And Dink Latham's already gone down to Porterville."
So they find the roads out when they come back, George said. They know the other way.
He reached into his pocket and took out a bulky styrofoam case. It held 5 detonators, each in its own fitted compartment. George took one out, put it onto the end of a fuse, crimped it with his teeth, and used his penknife to poke a hole in a dynamite stick. He pushed the detonator into the stick and shoved it into the hole.
No primer cord, he said. Have to put both sticks in the same hole. I think this'll do it.
He tamped wet mud down into the hole he'd scooped, covering the dynamite. Only the fuse end protruded. Ray turned his back to the wind and hunched low over a cigarette. He flicked the wheel of his Zippo until it caught and got the cigarette burning. Then, carefully, shielding the burning tobacco with his hat brim, he brought it down to the fuse end. The fuse sputtered once, then caught. It hissed softly in the rain. "Let's go," Ray said. He scrambled down the bank, George behind him. They had many minutes before the fuse burned down, but they ran as if pursued by furies. They were around the bend when they heard the explosion. It wasn't very loud. The rain dulled all sounds. George carefully backed the truck around until they could see. The road was covered with 4 feet of mud and boulders. More had tumbled across the road and down into the river valley below.
"Man might get over that with a four-wheel," George said. "Nothing else."
"What the hell are you sitting here for? Let's go!"
Ray's enraged bellow was too loud for the truck cab, but he knew his brother wouldn't say anything about it. There was water standing in the streets when they reached Porterville. It wasn't more than hubcap deep. The dam still held. The City Hall meeting room smelled of kerosene lamps and damp bodies. There was also the faint odor of books and library paste. There weren't many books in the library, and they took up space around the walls, but not in the center of the room. Senator Jellison looked at his electric watch and grimaced. It was good for another year, but then, why the hell didn't he have an old-fashioned wind-up? The watch told him it was 10:38 and 35 seconds, and it wouldn't be off by more than a second until the battery ran out. The room was nearly full. All the library tables had been moved to make room for more folding chairs. A few women, mostly men, mostly in farm clothes and rain gear, mostly unarmed. They smelled of sweat, and they were soaked and tired. 3 whiskey bottles moved rhythmically from hand to hand, and there were a lot of cans of beer. There wasn't much talk as they waited for the meeting to start. There were 3 distinct groups in the room. Senator Jellison dominated one of them. He sat with Mayor Seitz, Chief Hartman, and the constables. Maureen Jellison was part of the group, and in the front rows, right up front, were their close friends. A solid block of support for the Jellison party. Beyond them was the largest group, neutrals waiting for the senator and the mayor to tell them what to do. They wouldn't have put it that way, and the senator would never have dreamed of saying it flat out. They were farmers and merchants who needed help, and they weren't used to asking for advice. Jellison knew them all. Not well, but well enough to know that he could count on them, up to a point. Some of them had brought their wives. At the back, off in one corner, were George Christopher and his clan. Clan is the right word, Arthur Jellison thought. 12. All men, all armed. You'd know they were relatives just to look at them. Although Jellison knew it wasn't strictly true. 2 were brothers-in-law, but they looked like Christopher's. Heavy-set, red of face, and strong enough to lift jeeps in their spare time. The Christophers didn't precisely sit apart from everyone else, but they sat together, and they talked together, and they had few words for their neighbors. Steve Cox came in with 2 of Jellison's ranch hands. "Dam still holding," he shouted above rain and thunder and muted conversation. "Don't know what's keeping it together. There's water higher than the spillway behind it. It's eating out the banks at the sides."
"Won't be long now," one of the farmers said.
"Did we warn the people down in Porterville?"
"Yes," Chief Hartman said. "Constable Mosey told the Porterville police. They'll get people out of the flood area."
"What's the flood area?" Steve Cox asked. "Whole damn valley's filling up.
and the highway's out. They can't come up here.
Some have, Mayor Seitz said.
300, more or less, up the county road. Expect there'll be more tomorrow.
Too damn many,
Ray Christopher said. There was a babble of voices, some agreeing, some arguing. Mayor Seitz pounded for order.
Let's find out what we're facing, Seitz said. Senator, what have you learned?
Enough.
Jellison got up from his seat at the table and went around in front of it. He perched his buttocks on the table in an informal pose that he knew was effective.
I've got pretty good shortwave radio gear. I know there are amateurs trying to communicate, and I get nothing but static. Not just on amateur bands, on CB, commercial, even military. That tells me the atmosphere is all fouled up. Electrical storms. I don't need to guess about those, he said with a grin.
He waved expressively toward the windows, and as if on cue, lightning flared. There wasn't quite so much thunder and lightning as there'd been earlier in the day, but there was so much that no one noticed unless they were thinking about it.
And salt rain, Jellison said. And the earthquake. The last words I heard out of JPL were, "The hammer has fallen." I'd like to talk to somebody who was in the hills above L.A. when it happened. But what I've got adds up. The hammer hit us, and bad. We can be sure of it.
No one said anything. They'd all known it. They'd hoped to find out something different, but they knew better. They were farmers and businessmen tied closely to the land and the weather, and they lived in the foothills of the High Sierra. They'd known disaster before, and they'd done their crying and cursing at home. Now they were worried about what to do next.
We got 5 truckloads of feed and hardware and 2 of groceries out of Porterville today, Jellison said. And there's the stock in our local stores, and what you have in your barns. I doubt there'll be much else that we don't make or grow ourselves.
There were murmurs. One of the farmers said,
Not ever, Senator.
Might as well be never, Jellison said. Years, I think. We're on our own.
He paused to let that sink in. Most of these people prided themselves on being on their own. Of course, that wasn't true. Hadn't been true for generations, and they were smart enough to know it, but it would take them time to realize just how dependent they'd been on civilization. Fertilizers, breeding stock, vitamins, gasoline and propane, electricity, water, well, that wouldn't be much of a problem for a while. Medicines, drugs, razor blades, weather forecasts, seeds, animal feed, clothes, ammunition. The list was endless, even needles and pins and thread.
"We won't grow much this year," Stretch Tallison said. "My crops are in bad shape already."
Jellison nodded.
Tallison had gone down the road to help his neighbors harvest tomatoes, and his wife was working to can as many as she could. Tallison grew barley, and it wouldn't last the summer.
"Question is, do we pull together?" Jellison said.
"What do you mean, pull together?"
Ray Christopher asked.
Share, pool what we've got, Jellison answered.
You mean communism,
Ray Christopher said. This time the hostility showed through in his voice.
No, I mean cooperation. Charity, if you like. More than that, intelligent management of what little we have, so we avoid waste.
Sounds like communism.
Shut up, Ray. George Christopher stood.
Senator, I can see how that makes sense. No point in using the last of the gasoline to plant something that won't grow, or feeding the last of the soybeans to cattle that won't last the winter anyway. Question is, who decides? You?
Somebody has to, Tallison said.
Not alone, Jellison said. We elect a council. I will point out that I'm probably in better shape than anybody else here, and I'm willing to share.
Sure, Christopher said. But share with who, Senator? That's the big question. How far do we go? We try to feed Los Angeles.
That's absurd, Jack Turner said.
Why, they'll all be here. All that can get here,
Christopher shouted.
Los Angeles and the San Joaquin and what's left of San Francisco. Not all of them, maybe, but plenty. 300 last night, and that's just for starters. How long can we keep it up, letting those people come here?
Be niggers, too!
Someone shouted from the floor. He looked self-consciously at two black faces at the end of the room.
Okay, sorry. No, I'm not sorry. Lucius, you own land. You work it. But city niggers, whining about equality, you don't want them either.
The black man said nothing. He seemed to shrink away from the group, and he sat very quietly with his son.
Lucius Carter's all right, George Christopher said. But Frank's right about the others. City people, tourists, hippies. Be here in droves pretty soon. We have to stop them.
I'm losing it, Jellison thought. Too much fear here, and Christopher's put his finger on it. He shuddered. A lot of people were going to die in the next months. A lot. How do you select the ones to live, the ones to die? How do you be the chooser of the slain? God knows I don't want the job. George, what do you suggest? Jellison asked.
Roadblock on the county road. We don't want to close it, we may need it. So we put up a roadblock and we turn people away.
Not everyone,
Mayor Seitz said. Women and children.
Everybody!
Christopher shouted.
Women? We have women. And kids. Plenty of our own to worry about. We start taking in other people's kids and women, where do we stop? When our own are starving come winter?
Just who is going to man this roadblock? Chief Hartman asked. Who's tough enough to look at a car full of people and tell a man he can't even leave his kids with us?
You're not, George. None of us are.
The hell I'm not.
And there are special skills, Senator Jellison said. Engineers. We could use several good engineers. Doctors, veterinarians, brewers.
A good blacksmith, if there is any such thing in this modern world.
Used to be a fair hand at that,
Ray Christopher said.
Shod horses for the county fair.
All right, Jellison said. But there are plenty of skills we don't have, and don't think we won't need them. Okay, okay, George Christopher said. But damn it, we can't take in everybody.
And yet we must.
The voice was very low, not really loud enough to carry through the babble and the thunder, but everyone heard it anyway. A professionally trained voice.
I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. I was hungry, and ye fed me not. Is that what you want to hear at judgment?
The room was still for a moment. Everyone turned to look at the Reverend Thomas Varley. Most of them had attended his community church, had called him to their homes to sit with them when relatives died, sent their children with him on picnics and camping trips. Tom Varley was one of them, bred in the valley and lived there all his life, except for the years at college in San Francisco. He stood tall, a bit thinner since his 60th birthday a year before, but strong enough to help get a neighbor's cow out of a ditch. George Christopher faced him defiantly.
Brother Varley, we just can't do it. Some of us are likely to starve this winter. There's just not enough here.
Then why don't you send some away? Reverend Varley asked.
It might come to that,
George muttered. His voice rose.
I've seen it, I tell you. People with not enough to eat. Not even enough strength to come get chow when it's offered. Brother Varley, you want us to wait until we got no more choice than the Donner Party had. If we send people away now, they might find someplace they can make it. If we take them in, we'll all be looking next winter. It's that simple.
Tell 'em, George,
someone shouted from the far end of the meeting room. George looked around at the sea of faces. They were not hostile. Most were filled with shame, fear and shame. George thought that would be the way he'd look to them, too. He went on, doggedly.
We do something, and we do it right now, or I'll be damned if I'm going to cooperate. I'll take everything I have, all the stuff I brought up from Porterville today, too, and go home. And I can damn well shoot anybody who comes onto my place.
There were more murmurs. Reverend Varley tried to speak, but he was shouted down.
Damned right! We're with you, George!
Jellison's voice cut through.
I didn't say we shouldn't try to put up a roadblock. We were discussing practical difficulties.
Arthur Jellison couldn't look the clergyman in the face.
Good. Then we do it, George Christopher said. Ray, you stay here and tell me what happens in this meeting. Carl, Jake, rest of you, come with me. There'll be another 1,000 people here by morning if we don't stop them.
And besides, Jellison thought, it will be easier at night when you can't see their faces. Maybe by morning you'll be used to it. And if you truly get used to sending people off to die, will anyone want to know you? The worst of it was, George Christopher was right, but that didn't make it any easier. I'll have some of my people come with you, George, and we'll have a relief crew out in the morning.
Good.
Christopher went to the door. On the way, he stopped for a moment to smile at Maureen.
Good night, Melisande, he said.
One kerosene lamp burned in the living room of the Jellison house. Arthur Jellison sprawled in an easy chair, shoes off, shirt partly unbuttoned.
I'll leave those lists until tomorrow.
Yes, sir. Can I get you anything? Al Hardy glanced at his watch. 2 a.m.
No, Maureen can take care of me. Good night.
Hardy pointedly looked at his watch again. Getting late, Sender, and you're supposed to be up in the morning.
I'll turn in shortly. Good night.
This time the dismissal was pointed. Jellison watched his assistant leave, noted Hardy's determined look. It confirmed a guess Arthur Jellison had made earlier. That damned doctor at Bethesda Naval Hospital had told Hardy about the abnormal electrocardiograms, and Hardy was making like a mother hen. Had Al told Maureen? It didn't matter.
"Want a drink, Dad?"
Maureen asked.
"Water. We ought to save the bourbon," Jellison said.
"Sit down, please." The tone was polite, but it wasn't exactly a request. Not really an order, either. A worried man.
"Yes,"
she said. She took a chair near his.
"What did George Christopher mean? Who's Melisande, or whatever he said?"
"It's a long story."
"I want to hear it. Anything about the Christophers, I want to hear," Jellison said.
"Why?"
"Because they're the other power in this valley, and we've got to work together, and not against each other. I need to know just who's giving in to what," Jellison said. "Now tell me."
"Well, you know, George and I practically grew up together," Maureen said. "We're the same age."
"Sure."
"And before you went to Washington, when you were a state senator, George and I were in love. Well, we were only 14, but it felt like love."
And she didn't say, "I haven't really felt like that about anybody since."
"He wanted me to stay here, with him. I would have, too, if there'd been any way to do it. I didn't want to go to Washington."
Jellison looked older in the yellow kerosene light.
"I didn't know that. I was busy just then."
"It's all right, Dad," Maureen said.
"All right or not, it's done," Jellison said. "What's with Melisande?"
"Remember the play The Rainmaker? The confidence man plays up to the old maid farm girl. Tells her to stop calling herself Lizzie, to come with him and she'll be Melisande and they'll live a glamorous life. Well, George and I saw it that summer, and it was a switch, that's all. Instead of going off to the glamorous life in Washington, I should stay here with him. I'd forgotten all about it."
"You had, huh? You remember it now, though."
"Dad."
"What did he mean, calling you that?" Jellison asked.
"Well, I..."
She stopped herself and didn't say anything else.
"Yeah, I figure it that way, too," Jellison said. "He's telling you something, isn't he? How much have you seen of him since we went to Washington?"
"Not much."
"Have you slept with him?"
"That's none of your business," Maureen flared.
"The hell it's not. Anything and everything around this valley is my business just now, especially if it's got Christopher's mixed up in it."
"Did you?" "No."
"Did he try?"
"Nothing serious," she said. "I think he's too religious, and we didn't really have many opportunities. Not after I'd moved to Washington."
"And he's never married," Jellison said.
"Dad, that's silly. He hasn't been pining away from me for 16 years.
No, I don't suppose so. But that was a pretty definite message tonight. Okay, let's get to bed.
Dad.
Yes?
Can we talk? I'm scared.
She took the chair next to his. He thought she looked much younger just then, and remembered her when she was a little girl, when her mother was still alive.
It's bad, isn't it?
She asked.
About as bad as it gets, Jellison said.
He reached for the whiskey and poured himself two fingers.
May as well. We know how to make whiskey. If there's grain, we'll have booze. If there's grain.
What's going to happen?
Maureen asked.
I don't know. I can make some guesses.
He stared at the empty fireplace. It was damp from rain coming down the chimney.
Hammerfall. By now the tidal waves have swept around the world. Seacoast cities are all gone. Washington's gone. I hope the capital survived. I like that old granite pile.
He fell silent for a moment, and they listened to the steady pounding rain and rolling thunder.
I forgot who said it, Jellison said. It's true enough. No country is more than 3 miles away from a revolution. Hear that rain? It's all over the country. Lowlands, river bottoms, little creeks, any low places in the roads, they'll be underwater, just like the whole San Joaquin Valley's going to be underwater. Highways, railroads, river travel, it's all gone. There's no transportation and not much communication, which means the United States has ceased to exist. So have most other countries.
But,
she shivered, although it wasn't cold in the room,
there have to be places that aren't damaged. Cities not on the coast, mountain areas that don't have earthquake faults. They'll still be organized.
Will they? How many places can you think of that have food enough to last for weeks?
I never thought about it.
Right. And it isn't weeks. It's months, Jellison said.
Kitten, what do people eat?
The United States has about 30 days' food at any given time. That's everything. Warehouses, supermarkets, grain elevators, ships in harbor. A lot of it was lost. A lot more is perishable. And there isn't going to be diddly for a crop this fall. Do you expect anybody who's got barely enough to eat to come out and help anybody else?
Oh, and it's worse than that.
His voice was brutal now, almost as if he were trying to frighten her.
Refugees everywhere. Any place there's enough to eat, there'll be people after food. Don't blame them. We could have 1 million refugees on the way here right now. Maybe here and there the police and local governments try to survive. How do they manage when the locusts come? Only, they're not locusts, they're people.
But, what do we do?
Maureen cried.
We survive, we live through it, and we build a new civilization.
Somebody's got to. His voice rose.
We can do it. How soon depends on how far we get knocked down. All the way to savagery. Bows and arrows and stone clubs. I'll be damned if we can't do better than that.
Yes, of course.
No, of course about it, kitten.
Jellison sounded very old, but his voice held determination and strength.
It depends on what we can keep. Keep right here. We don't know what's left anywhere else, but here we're in pretty good shape if we can just hang on. Here we've got a chance, and by God, we're going to take it.
You'll do it, Maureen said. It's your job.
Think of anybody else who can.
I wasn't asking a question, Dad.
Then remember that when I've got to do something I don't much like.
He set his jaw hard.
We're going to make it, kitten, I promise you. The people of this valley are going to live through this and come out civilized.
Then he laughed.
I do go on. It's time for bed. A lot of work to do tomorrow.
All right.
You don't need to wait for me. I'll be along.
Git. She kissed him and left. Arthur Jellison drained the whiskey glass and set it down with a long look at the bottle. He sat staring into the empty fireplace. He could see how a civilization could be built from the wreckage Lucifer's hammer had left. Salvage work,
plenty to salvage in the old seacoast cities. The water hadn't destroyed everything. New oil wells could be drilled. The railroads could be repaired. These rains wouldn't last forever. We can rebuild it, and this time we'll do it right. We'll spread beyond this one damned little ball. Get human civilization out all through the solar system, to other stars even, so no one thing can knock us out again. Sure we can. But how do we live long enough to start rebuilding? First things first, and right now the problem is getting this valley organized. Nobody's going to help. We have to do it ourselves. The only law and order will be what we can make, and the only safety Maureen and Charlotte and Jennifer will have is what we can put together. I used to be responsible to the people of the United States, and particularly to the people of California. Not anymore. Now it's my family, and how can I protect them? That boils down to how do I keep this ranch, and maybe I can't do that, not without help. Whose help? George Christopher, for one. George has a lot of friends. Between us, we can do all right. Arthur Jellison got wearily to his feet and blew out the kerosene lamp. In the sudden dark, the pounding rain and crashing thunder sounded even louder. He could see his way to the bedroom through lightning flashes. There was a light under Al Hardy's door. It went out after Hardy heard the senator get into bed. Sanctuary. God gives all men all earth to love. But since man's heart is small, ordains for each one spot shall prove beloved over all. Rudyard Kipling. Harvey Randall woke to strident sounds. Someone was screaming at him.
Harvey! Help!
Loretta? He sat up suddenly and banged his head on something. He'd been asleep in the travel-all, and the voice wasn't Loretta's. For a moment he was bewildered. What was nightmare? What was real?
Harvey!
The shouting voice was real, and, oh God, Loretta was dead. It was raining, but there was no rain around the travel-all. He opened the door and blinked in the dim light. His watch said 6 o'clock. Morning or evening? The travel-all was parked under a rickety shed, no more than a roof with posts to hold it up. Marie Vance stood at the far end. Joanna was holding the shotgun on her. Mark was shouting, and Marie was screaming for Harvey. None of it made sense. Half-light, driving rain and howling wind, lightning and thunder, the screaming woman and Mark shouting, and Joanna with the shotgun. Dream or real? He made himself move toward the others. "What is this, Mark?" Mark turned and saw him. His face lighted with a smile. That faded, too, like Harvey's dream that it was a dream, like...
"Harvey! Tell him!"
Marie shouted. He shook the cobwebs from his head. They wouldn't go. "Mark?" he said. Marie jerked like a puppet. Harvey stared in astonishment as she did it again. She seemed to be fighting an invisible enemy. Then, suddenly, she relaxed, and her voice was calm, or nearly so. "Harvey Randall, it's time you woke up," she said. "Or don't you care about your son? You've buried Loretta, now think about Andy." He heard himself speak. "What is all this?" They both talked at once. The need for understanding, rather than any other emotion, made Harvey speak sharply.
"One at a time! Mark, please, let her talk."
"This man wants to abandon our boys," Marie said.
"I don't! I'm trying to tell you—"
she cut Mark off. "The boys are in Sequoia. I told him that. Sequoia. But he keeps taking us west, and that's not the right way."
"All of you, shut up!"
Joanna shouted. There was an edge of hysteria in her voice, and it stopped Mark before he could say anything else. He'd never heard Joanna shout before. Not like that. And she had the shotgun.
"Where are we going, Mark?" Harvey asked.
"To Sequoia," Mark said. "That's a big place, and she doesn't know where—"
"I do," Harvey said. "Where are we?"
"Simi Valley," Mark said. "Will you listen to me?"
"Yes, talk."
"Harvey, he's—" "Shut up, Marie."
Harvey made his voice deliberately brutal. It stopped her.
"Harv, there's people all over," Mark said. "Roads were getting jammed, so I cut off onto a fire trail I know about. Bikers use it. It'll lead us through the Condor Reservation. Sure, it goes west a while, but we stay off the goddamn freeways. You stop to think how many people are trying to get out of L.A. right now. Not many know about this road, and it stays on high ground. It wasn't much of a road to begin with, less to go wrong with it."
He turned to Marie.
"That's what I was trying to tell you."